This week's episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 24th of April 2012 here on Monocle 24. Section D in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Anyone with even a passing interest in design won't fail to have noticed that last week was the 51st Salone del Mobile, Milan's gargantuan annual furniture fair. We were out in force for the week, reporting each morning live from the studios of Il Sole 24 Ore, with a stellar cast of guests from all angles of the industry and corners of the globe, together with a string of reports from the fair and city each day. On this week's Section D, we've brought you a roundup of all the action as it unfolded day by day. Coming up, we'll hear from editor-in-chief of Domus magazine, Joseph Griemer, about the future of how things might be made.
But what is incredible is that he's actually producing, for the duration of Salon, he's producing chairs inside of Palazzo Clerici in a process similar to that of a 3D printer, but scaled up to the size of a room.
We'll talk the Milan 2015 Expo plans with the city's leading urbanist, Stefano Boeri.
All these events could really accelerate the transformation of the city, but this happens only when the city uses events like a goal.
And we'll talk the alarming rise of the trend forecaster with Danish designer and consultant Thomas Ligger.
I think it's dangerous actually to adjust your products just to fit into a certain market. Mm. I don't like the way of doing productions or products. I think it's kind of fake.
All that to come, plus numerous news, views and voices from the fair, right here on Section D. Stay tuned. Italy has one of the richest industrial and craft heritages in the world, and Milan, over the last century, has been at the heart of it. As craft gave way to industry, and industry to technology, the way we make things has changed significantly. A groundbreaking exhibition took place during the Salone at the Palazzo Clerici, in the heart of Milan. It was called The Future in the Making. Joseph Griemer, editor of Domus magazine, curated the exhibition, and I caught up with him on day one. I began by asking where the idea for the exhibition had come from.
The title of the exhibition, The Future in the Making, is a clear nod to the maker movement, to all of the transformations that are impacting the technology around making things these days. I mean, digital in the past 20 years has completely revolutionized how we communicate. And now there's a sea change also in its impact on the manufacturing process. And of course, this here in Milan, being a place which is, especially during the Salone del Mobile, a massive showcase of incredibly beautiful things, it's inevitable that sooner or later one has to start to consider how these things are made and how digital technologies are actually going to transform them, not just from the point of view of their appearance, and but also their functionality and the economics, the economic models behind them. So The Future in the Making is really an attempt to actually kind of dig into this and to present what we call a kind of an archipelago of open design archipelago, an archipelago of ideas, individuals who are working on this idea, kind of trying to inject new models, new processes, new approaches to design through, I'd say, a dozen different projects that we're grouping together.
Tell us a little bit about one or two of the projects that are in
We have the first thing you'll see when you enter the Palazzo Clerici, I should say, it's one of the most beautiful
Clerici, sorry, I said Clerici.
No, it's those Italian phonetics.
It's the C's, they always trip me up.
Exactly. The Palazzo Clerici is it's an incredibly beautiful 17th century palazzo, Tiepolo, frescoes on the ceiling and so on. We chose it as precisely for this contrast between the kind of technological future and the artigianale, they say, the past of the great Italian masters. So when you enter the ballroom, for example, you're confronted with a Sola Cinta machine, which is a project by RCA graduate Marcus Kaiser. He designed and built this incredible machine that looks like a Mars rover, which he took out into the Moroccan desert. And he actually used it to focus. It has a very large array of solar collectors that focus a beam of very intense light on a small bed of sand. And this is connected to a small processor, a pre-programmed processor, that actually moves the beam around, transforming it into a solar printer, 3D solar-powered printer. So it's actually a 3D printer that operates in the middle of a desert and transforms sand into bowls or other small items. It's a clearly kind of quite far-out imaginative project that imagines that deserts could actually be the factories of the future.
But this is, I mean, precisely the point behind the exhibition, presumably, is it's trying to push people to think about the future. It's not all just about sort of making chairs, and as much as the preservation of craft and traditional skills is very important.
Absolutely.
You know, the discussion about what will the things of 100 years from now be made from and how will they be made, it's a discussion that's kind of been absent from Salerno for quite a long time. Was that your intention, to sort of open up the dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about the Salone is that for many years it's kind of been the emblem of Italian craftsmanship and skill and so on. And of course, the economics of that are becoming more and more difficult as the price of labor increases steadily, the price of industrial manufacturing decreases. Of course, there's this kind of moment when it just becomes anti-economical to produce things according to traditional models. So what we're really interested in, actually, in a way, it's a wake-up call to the Italian industry as well, to the furniture, kind of the universe of furniture production, trying to say that actually, maybe if we were to combine these incredible traditional skills with new technologies that mean that, just to give you one more example, we have Dirk van der Kooi, who's a Dutch designer, probably 28, 29 years old, who brought an industrial robot to Palazzo Clerici, 2.5 tons, incredible, huge piece of equipment. But what is incredible is that he's actually producing, for the duration of Salone, he's producing chairs inside of Palazzo Clerici in a process similar to that of a 3D printer, but scaled up to probably the size of a room. So actually, this is trying to say that actually one of the benefits of all of this is that manufacturing could possibly return to not just to the Western world, but to actually the centres of cities. You can imagine a future in which you go into a design store and your chair is printed out on the spot for you. And this is not science fiction. We're going to be doing it starting today.
I can't wait to see it. I mean, another thing that strikes me is the fact that this puts the power back into the sort of designer's hands. The
Absolutely.
Focus on sort of manufacturer or the retailer being sort of the one who holds the keys to, well, the money, and the sort of who says yes and who says no about what goes into production. Sort of the power balance shifts back to the designer's favour. After last year at Salone, there was a huge discussion about designers not being paid properly. Do you think designers will all be thinking, actually, this is the way that we need to work? We need to not just sort of be creating new designs, but thinking about ways in which we can control the way that they're created ourselves too?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that to give you another example, one of the things in the exhibition is a small collection of objects that were actually, rather than being industrialized through a relationship with a company in which a company invests a certain amount of money in injection molds and so on, they were actually funded entirely via Kickstarter. So we have 12 objects that were all actually self-produced by designers who pitched ideas on Kickstarter, got often 300, 500, 5,000% of the funding that they originally, their goal, and then put these objects into production. This is a completely new model, not just in terms of the manufacturing process, but actually the economic model behind it, because it's a direct relationship between the developer, the designer, and the end user. And I think that's something really fascinating, possibly even more fascinating than the industrial production process, these new technologies of manufacturing, is actually the new economic models that are possible if you combine the internet with 3D printing and crowdsourcing. I mean, that's a pretty powerful model.
That was me with Joseph Grima, editor of Domus, on day one of the Salone del Mobile. This year saw the opening of a new venue in Milan. Most, at the Museum of Science and Technology, hosted a collection of shows, big and small, spanning design, food, retail and industry of all kinds. British designer Tom Dixon was the man behind it, and I caught up with him to find out why there was need for yet another new hub.
So we're here at the Science Museum in Milan and at an event that we've called MOST, which is an acronym for Museum of Science and Technology. But here it really is, we've put the most we could possibly think of in the museum. We've got 500,000 square foot of space in different buildings, in a 16th century monastery, in some 50s industrial sheds. And we're surrounded by submarines and trains and boats and Leonardo da Vinci's models. Partly because we've got no choice. I mean, Milan Furniture Fair has become now a kind of playground for big corporates. So increasingly people have got $1 million budgets and they can take the pick of the spaces. But some of the obvious spots have become oversubscribed and, dare I say, naff. And this has always been an oasis of peace and quiet, which I used to come to just to get away from design. So unfortunately I've ruined that by bringing in God knows how many other exhibitors and opening up the museum to the fair. I think what unites the exhibitors here is really designers taking charge again. You know? So up to now, really, it's the brands or the manufacturers that have had the power. So here it's really more about the designers speaking out and taking control. And you'll see a lot of that in Milan this year anyway. People are forced to because there's no real business going on. You know?
SodaStream is actually a British brand, 100 years old. And what happened is that obviously it's been an icon of the 70s and 80s. And by 2005, it was on the brink of collapse. It was bought by venture capital, turned around. 2010, it was already floated on the NASDAQ for $1 billion. So before we even got to kind of do all the design revolution, we did a business revolution for this brand. And late last year, we basically started talking about, okay, now we've got a company that actually grows very fast. The US market is a new market. This year, it's become like the best market for SodaStream, and it continues so, hopefully. Let's deal with the design now. So we decided to work with Eve on this machine. Obviously, SodaStream is now an extremely ecological product. It became very relevant again. And obviously, Eve has been an extremely important designer working within social and ecological circles. So it was a perfect choice to work with SodaStream. Okay. So I'm just going to show you.
Yeah,
sorry. If you want it slightly carbonated, it's here.
Yeah.
More carbonated. But still, you know, no plugs. You know, no nothing, and one action. So, besides the fact that it's like a beautiful machine, the function of it is completely different. The user experience is completely different.
How do you manage to sort of turn around people's perceptions of a brand like SodaStream when you say everybody remembers it from their childhood, probably have one in the back of a cupboard somewhere? How do you manage to persuade people that actually they need a SodaStream in their life again?
Because we all know that now it's not about carrying plastic bottles everywhere and transporting them from place to place. Here you've got a product that basically resolves the ecological issue.
We are here with Carpigiani Gelato University, the most prestigious school in the world dedicated to artisan gelato, to teach designers and architects how to make the real gelato. And so every day, five times a day, we'll organize workshops named Design Your Gelato and Taste It, because they finish with a degustation, and in which we'll explain then how to make gelato. And Tom Dixon will be the judge of a special award, Designing Gelato Cone Evolution, that aims to develop a new gelato cone, because since 1903 there's only one shape where to eat gelato.
But do you not think the reason why there's only one shape is because it works so well? Is there a need for another shape?
I think there's a need for another shape. You know, you sit on a chair every day, but in the world there are a lot of shapes of chairs, as tables, lamps, and so it could be better, who knows, to eat gelato in another shape, perhaps a flower, a moon. The most important thing is that it's useful and aesthetically nice, because the cone is something happy. When you eat a gelato, you become a child and you remember when you were eating gelato with your parents. And so I think the shape of the cone of the future must be funny and useful and full of good thoughts.
Triumph is one of the world's largest manufacturers of sheet metal machines, and on this particular machine we are right now punching particular parts from a sheet metal in order to produce lamps designed by Tom Dixon.
And so what we're listening to in the background is the sheet metal being laser cut.
No, it's punched right now, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then what comes out of it at the end is sheet metal that you just fold into the lamp.
In a three-dimensional form, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very, very clever. So it's very economical with the material that's used as well, is it?
Yeah, it is indeed, because metal you can always remelt again. If you don't use it anymore, or the rest of the raw materials, you can melt in again. And so it's another thing compared to plastics, which you basically have to care for in a particular way. Yeah. Metal can always be remelted.
And so the machine is called the True Punch 3000.
Exactly, yeah.
And is that made in Germany?
It is made in Germany, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And what other things does it get used for?
Wherever you have sheet metal, you need these kinds of machines. For instance, if you have an espresso machine at home, it is highly likely that it has been manufactured on one of our machines.
And what do you think having a machine like this kind of on show during the Salone del Mobile sort of gives to people who come and see it?
I mean, design is one thing, but the processes behind the design are quite important as well.
That was me with a select mix of exhibitors at the new venue, Most. Time for a short break, but stay with us. We'll be finding out how the next generation of design talent fared during the fair. After this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus. Creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Detractors often accuse Italy of being run by old men, and with a record youth unemployment rate of nearly 30%, they have a point. It's particularly difficult for Italy's young creatives to get a foot on the ladder, with little support for entrepreneurs and startups too. But it's not all doom and gloom. There's a new breed of driven young Italians keen to shake things up a bit on home turf. I was joined in the studio on day two by one of them. Marco Velardi is founder of Appartamento magazine and creative director of one of Milan's best-loved furniture brands, Di Padova. I began by asking Marco if it's true that opportunities for young designers in Italy have dried up.
I think a lot of people do leave even before, I mean, studying. You know, a lot of people are trying to study abroad. I mean, it's much easier nowadays in Europe. You can move much more freely. I went to London. Study there, but I came back. I mean, other people don't come back because, I mean, there's not much opportunity. Everything is pretty much stuck with the old, you know, the establishment. So if you're young and want to start, design agency, it's not going to be easy here. I mean, you really have to push or find some connections.
We're here in Milan, and Milan, sort of in the post-war era, and sort of every 10 years has had this incredible generation of young people who've really sort of pushed brand Italy forward and what sort of made in Italy means as well. Does that exist today, do you think? I mean,
well, I think there is. I mean, there's a lot of examples of that. I mean, for example, there's a brand called Super. They do sunglasses, and they started a few years ago. And I think that when they started, we're all below 30, and you know, a successful brand distributed internationally. They're going well. That's an example of this kind of creativity, you know, and that you can see. I mean, it's happening, but it's difficult. You have to study on your own. They had a smaller magazine that was financing through advertising the other business, and suddenly the new business moves up, and that's the way you kind of have to juggle. But nobody's going to give you any business injection or, you know, like money or even resources, spaces. You know, it's really hard. I mean, you know, if you want to rent a space, it's going to be really expensive. So you have to find your way around things.
And Milan in particular has quite a special sort of brand image, mm-hmm. that is quite different to the rest of Italy. And sort of events from the last year and sort of beyond with Berlusconi have sort of damaged Italy's brand. But do you feel like Milan has managed to sort of stay a little bit separate from that?
In a way, I mean, especially with the change, with Pisapia coming to power, if you say that. And I think it changed a little bit. I mean, still it Italy is a big machine, and especially politically wise. I think Milan is the only place I would stay in the sense of working. There's a lot of beautiful cities and there's a lot of going on. I mean, also creatively in many other places. But for myself, I think it's the only very international hub we have. And I really would push to stay here. I mean, I try to work and continue in that sense. So I think Milan is definitely driving the brand Italy, or the young creative brand Italy, forward, I hope.
Moving on to your sort of second hat that you wear, which is a more recent one, as the creative director of De Padova. De Padova is one of Italy's more cherished furniture brands. And the furniture and design brands in Italy have also sort of been accused of getting stuck in sort of the older generations. But their decision to bring you in, is that sort of a move that you feel like other Italian manufacturers would be wise to do?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, in a sense, I was very flattered when they asked me, and quite surprised too. I mean, it's a more than 55 years old company, still family owned. And I think it was very refreshing in that sense. I felt it was an opportunity to do something different than, as you say, many other brands, which I think is still stuck. I think it's because of the nature of them, you know, like most of them are also like family in a way. And, you know, you pass it not to generation, but sometimes the generation after is not so interested or so driven to make it an international, or, you know, they already find things ready. I think with De Padova, there's a big opportunity to develop it also, bring the sort of made in Italy of De Padova abroad and make it more consistent. It doesn't have to be bigger, you know, it has to be just relevant to the people that like that brand and new people that want to find out. I think in a sense, there are a few brands, like maybe not the one around Milan, that use young art directors and creative directors. I don't know to what degree power they have within the company to deal with, but I find myself having a lot to deal with, and it's very interesting. And also, I would hope many other brands will do that.
And it's quite unusual, like you say, for a historic family brand to bring someone who's not part of the family in and to sort of give them a little bit of
space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. Room to sort of experiment and do what they want.
I think they're really experimenting with me. I mean, they always work with Castiglioni or Vico Magistretti, and in a way, that was the choice at the moment. And I think that's, you know, also the Easter that I have there, that, you know, is always looking at me when I'm deciding new things in there. I think that's also a challenge with many brands. I mean, if you bring a new art director or young creative, people are always scared they're going to do something wrong or mess it up. I think there's a lot of generation that is really interested in the past and can cultivate it to make it contemporary.
Exactly.
So I hope more people will come back to Italy or will get jobs here within the industry.
That was Marco Velardi, founder of Appartamento magazine and creative director of De Padova, in the studio on day two of the Salone del Mobile. And on the topic of young designers, we headed to the area of the fairground devoted to young talent, Salone Satellite. Celebrating its 15th anniversary this year, it's where graduates and studios under the age of 30 head to show their prototypes in the hope that a hungry manufacturer will snap them up. I spoke to Augustin Scott de Martinville, one of the founders of Big Game, who exhibited at Satellite in 2006 and have since gone on to carve a successful business as a design studio. We then dropped in on two first-time exhibitors at the Satellite to quiz them on their rather special new prototypes.
Our original plan was to showcase in town, like have an exhibition in a gallery, and we realized that if we want to, you know, really work with professionals, we had to be here actually in the fair. And this is a much better way actually to be in the fair, because you just meet so many people. We're producing stuff ourselves at one point, and now we're really gradually moving back to the old school of design, because we're really sure right now that we want to be industrial, we want to go for mass production, and we are looking for industrial partners. That's what got us started in the first place, wanting to be designers, is design objects for everyday life. So that's really our goal now. The thing is that one way is to produce yourself, and the other way is to actually be really like an entrepreneur and show it to people. So we thought, you know, since we're going to be in the fair, it's going to be easier for us to go to the commercial side and meet people and have appointments. And that's really our goal during this week, is to meet people and get like proper industrial contracts.
So the Salone is still where it happens in terms of connecting people.
You know, in our situation now, we've done the, you know, young designer stuff, the prototype, the gallery, the handmade, the homemade, the DIY, and now we really want to move to contacting people and making industrial products.
I'm Noel Zara. I'm from Malta. The product is Koishi and it targets interaction with plants.
And what you've done is you've sort of treated a plant a bit like a lie detector treats a human. It tracks the pulse in the plant and then converts it into a form of music.
It doesn't just use the sound as a media, it also uses light. The light that you're seeing emitted from the bottom is actually corresponding to the note that is being played at the moment.
Where did the idea to sort of tap into plants in this way come from?
I have always noticed that, and something that actually bothered me, is that plants were almost turning into pieces of furniture. Nowadays, we also are spending hours on our mobile phone, on our computer, that's interacting with materials. Yet, we have surpassed a living object. We don't hear anyone talking about interacting with plants, otherwise you're considered as foolish, almost.
So the idea is that you would then sit down and put the headphones on and just sort of relax to the sound of your plant?
Yeah. I wouldn't mind, to be honest with you, cooking to the sound of my rosemary.
My name is Chaiyin and I'm a product designer and interaction designer from Taipei. And this is my work. It's called Tick Tick Tick. So it's a bedside lamp. You can set the time by pulling this stripe and it will gradually roll back and eventually it will turn off. So you don't have to worry about leaving the light when you fell asleep.
So this is like a measuring tape that you just pull down, and when you put it all the way down to the bottom.
Yeah, actually it could be longer.
Oh, it could be longer. Yes. And so there we've got 50 minutes and gradually it goes up.
Yes.
And then the light switches off.
Yeah.
And the idea for it came from sort of energy saving, presumably.
Actually it's... because I don't like to get up and turn off the light when I'm really cozy on bed. So this is where it comes from.
Okay, well, the best designs start from human experience and thinking about what could be made better. And this is a prototype at the moment, is it?
Actually very close to production.
Will it just be in Taiwan or will it be... No.
Actually, we might go to UK. Yeah.
Please do.
Yeah. So, yeah, actually there are some channels interested and we probably will talk to them later.
Fantastic. So Satellite, where you're showing, it's still a very good kind of market for you to be able to make a business and a living as a designer, do you think?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. This is my first time here.
That was me at the Satellite area of the Salone del Mobile with Augustin Scott de Martinville and two first-time exhibitors. Time now to catch up with some more faces to be found at the Salone del Mobile fairgrounds. And while some design brands churn out individual pieces each year to wow the crowds, the Italian heavy hitters tend to create environments, carefully adding elements that create a complete look for your home. It doesn't just keep the core of the brand intact. It means the contract market comes knocking for entire rooms, hotels and developments to be kitted out too. Multani and C is one of the best. And our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho sat down with CEO Carlo Multani at the fairground to hear more.
Now for Multani, do you have any particular anti-recession recipe to navigate these times?
Recipe is to make good furniture with a reasonable price compared to the quality that we produce. If you mention geographically, we have for sure a booming in between Hong Kong and China. And a good result in India, where we discovered the country 3 years ago and we have already very good result.
There's a strong appeal there for the Italian design in India?
More the quality than the design. They understand that they can have a better quality compared to their normal supplier, that is China supplier. So we are fighting against the China, but we win many times.
How much business is generated from this trade for talking to retailers, buyers?
Salone is a kind of a show, and what is important is what happens later on. We don't do the order during the Salone, but we can say that the year starts from the Salone.
In these economic times, have you noticed any changes in the consumer's taste?
We try to satisfy the needs of the people with less element, with not proposing enormous monument, but proposing the system in a way, in an intelligent way, where with few pieces you satisfy the needs of the consumer, that's all. We never be luxurying the luxury habits. Now we do something that is quite similar with Joe Ponti. We remake the furniture designed by Joe Ponti in the 50s with an extraordinary quality, taking care of producing in the same material and the same finishing as it was right in the drawing, the original drawing. And this is, let's say, luxury in a certain way, but even that is not so expensive, is reasonable compared to the quality of the product.
How important still is the Made in Italy brand?
No, Made in Italy is a very important brand. We know that every country of the world, when you say Made in Italy, is something. In our fields is a little bit different, because Made in Italy means a lot of things, also not so fantastic quality. And so we are able to work only in a limited area around in Brianza, where we have all our subcontractors that are not subcontractors, but that are persons that work 100% for our companies. And a job like this one of Joe Ponti, we can do it only because we have the control of the quality every day and every hour, let's say. And so we are sure that at the end, the quality will be what we intend to do.
That was our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, with Carlo Molteni, CEO of Molteni & C, at the Milan Fairgrounds on day 3. Time for a brief musical reprieve. Here's a nice bit of Italian formaggio to get you in the mood. This is Sposati Subito by Irene Grandi. Let's go, al mio via, let's go, meno due. Meno uno, are you ready? Let's go! Ci siamo presi una cosa alla prima. That was Sposati Subito by Irene Grandi. You're listening to a special Salone del Mobile themed Section D here on Monocle 24. The design industry is more global today than ever. One brand that made its European debut last week is called Stellar Works. It's a mashup of French, Danish, Japanese and Chinese design and craft, masterminded by the entrepreneurial young Dane, Thomas Ligger. He's the CEO of OEO, and he joined me and Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, in the studio on day 3 to tell us more.
Have you almost noticed that there's been a bit of an unleashing of creativity? Because I was talking to someone from the fashion business yesterday, and he said it was interesting that they've been working in China, and he said that they actually found this family, which was really famous for embroidering, but they really had to keep it under the radar for generations, because it was just, you know, it was frowned upon because they had, you know, they were part of the imperial past, and so, you know, it was really taboo. But the family had sort of still kept up this tradition quite literally in their basement. So the craftsmen that you're working with as well, do you find that also, you know, there are pockets of talent, you know, within Shanghai or other regions in China where people are saying, oh, and putting up their hands saying, you know, this is something I want to be involved with?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's many things we not yet have discovered from China, and I think it's coming up really quickly. They are, yeah, I mean, just like the last 20 years of China, how they have evolved. Talking about the Chinese market and how they are actually also changing in mentality. And actually, I read this report by a British guy called Rupert. Very interesting reading about how, you know, they have one thing in common. They're actually more dollar billionaires in China than there is in America now. And they're actually all going through a generation shift. They have an average age of 52. Their wife is 48. Their daughter or son is 28, study abroad. And that's interesting, because then when the generation shift comes, it's actually people that has a global mindset and not a Chinese mindset. So that's also how I think we will see China evolve over the next 5 years into becoming much more global and less, even less Chinese.
We were also talking about the Italian brands, and well, not just Italian brands, but sort of brands that are chasing the Chinese market by sort of making themselves a little bit more Chinese to appeal to them. Do you think that these brands that have actively kind of pushed that will, in a few years, once this generation grows up, this sort of more globally minded generation, they don't really want to feel like they've been catered for? They want to buy the real thing because they like it.
They want to buy the real thing. I think it's dangerous, actually, to adjust your products just to fit into a certain market. I don't like the way of doing productions or products. I think it's kind of fake. So I think you really have to be true to what you do and not just make it gold because the market says gold. I mean, you really have to stick to the core of your brand and believe in what you're doing. You know, you can say design from the heart to the heart. You have to reach people in the guts, you know.
But actually, on that point of chasing what people say you should be doing, it amazes me that Pantone said that orange was the colour for this year, and the number of really brilliant design brands that have pushed all their orange products to the front of their stands at the fair. It just seems so stupid.
Are you going to redecorate your flat?
No, I'm not. I'm not going to touch it.
You're going to reupholster your chair when we get back to London. But I mean, that's what it's an interesting point, though, that, you know, of course, there are always things which are trends, but, you know, oftentimes, you know, you see that so many companies use, let's say, the same forecasting people, and just it's always an interesting story, just how many companies do rely, you know, on colorists, and you would think, well, you almost have the sense that they would really have their own idea, but then just for validation, they feel that they want to be on trend. Do you feel, I mean, we've all been doing this for a while, and I throw this out to both of you. I mean, Thomas, when you look around, not just at the competitors, but just at the landscape, that has the narrative that you see in terms of trends almost become too tight, that it's only sort of four or five big things as opposed to, you know, 20 sort of streams that are in the market?
Well, first of all, I don't believe in trends when it comes to furniture making or jewelry or what.
You're going to put lots of design journalists out of business.
Yeah. You know, I don't believe in that. I think it's I would find it very, very difficult to work with a certain palette of colors or materials, and yet again you will not be unique, because then again everybody else would do it. They would do the same thing, like you just said, Hugo, everything is orange this year. That's so last season. I mean, the magazine Tyler mentioned earlier, was that was the 50th anniversary. That was orange. I remember that. Because I made that cover.
what do you think?
No, I agree. And also, actually, when you reduce what furniture and design is, it's sort of things that we live with. And that's not really dictated by trend that can be changed every year or every season. It's something that, you know, follows a much more holistic, sort of organic growth.
Yeah, I think it comes down to reason for being and longevity. Exactly. Because when you follow trends, you make it very narrow, very short time.
Yeah.
I mean, it will have a very short time life. And I think that's what furniture making and is different from fashion. Fashion is something you wear for a season. Furniture making is very different. You don't want to buy
only you wear it for a season. Do you still have your kung fu pants that you used to wear 10 years ago?
Thomas,
I bought new ones.
That was CEO of OEO, Thomas Ligger. In the studio with me and Tyler Brulé on day 3 of the fair. Milan is, of course, as much a home to fashion as it is to furniture. And in recent times, the boundaries between the two industries have become increasingly blurred. Bottega Veneta launched its second collection of homeware and furniture last week in its Milan headquarters, and I dropped by creative director Thomas Meyer's studio to hear more about it.
This Salone del Mobile, we added on two new groups. One of them is a new seating group that we collaborated on with Poltrona Frau. That group is based on the idea of that typical Bottega Veneta's signature softness. It looks simple, but actually it was pretty complex when we started to work on it with the technicians, because softness, you know, there's soft and there's too soft, you know? So I wanted it to be visually inviting and physically inviting once you sit down. But I think then there's a point when you sit down, okay, this is welcoming and pleasant, but okay, is it going to stop? Am I going down, down, down? So there I, you know, we did quite a bit of studying, you know, like the interior life of the seat and bringing it really to the level that you have that experience, like nice, but there's a certain firmness. Okay, now I'm sitting. It is about a timeless design. It is about great quality. It's about functionality. And it is about the make. So those cornerstones apply to anything we do, from a handbag to a dress to a man's suit or a briefcase, you know, whatever. As a starting point, I'll start always with color. When it comes to clothing and accessories, here this is not the case. You know, I'm not starting working on furniture pieces with color. I'm really starting about an idea of a concept. And then, obviously, color is very important. And all those colors that you can see in the showroom, they're all custom made. You look at it really close up, you can say, okay, this is really beautifully made and this is really nice design, because these proportions really work, and this is something, you know, that will probably withstand time, and that will look actually better the longer I have it. I mean, that leather couch will be 10 times better in 15 years than it looks today, once it has a certain liftiness and it takes on the character of its owner. I think it will be a whole different story.
That was Bottega Veneta's creative director, Thomas Meyer, in his Milan studio last week. Time for a short break. Stay with us. We'll be finding out about the Milan Expo in 2015 after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Section D. Much of the Salone is about celebrating Milan's role as a catalyst in the design world. And much of the work of our next guest is to make sure the city continues to play a leading role as a design hub. For the last year, architect Stefano Boeri has served as councillor for culture, design and fashion for the city of Milan. Outside of politics, he was previously editor-in-chief of Domus, before moving to rival publication Abitari. He's played an active role in the run-up to Milan's hosting of the World Expo in 2015, and has buildings under construction that are part of a larger effort to shake up Milan's skyline. Stefano Boeri joined me on day 4 of the fair to tell me more about the plans for Milan's 2015 Expo.
I'm now following as councillor for culture what is happening within the city for Expo. And for instance, on Monday, next Monday, we'll present a series of events about, feeding, the question of feeding and so on. So, you know, I was part of a group of architects together with Jacques Herzog and Ricky Bardet and William McDonough, who developed a scheme, quite a conceptual scheme for Expo. I have to be honest, that kind of thing has been completely transfigured at the moment. So what will happen in the place, in the site for the Expo, will be different from what we proposed 3 years ago. But, well, we are in any case extremely interested to Expo. I think we will help Milano to do a step in the direction of a modernization, and also, I hope, to be like a crucial point where gather all the thoughts and discussion about seating.
There's two things. The first is, obviously, the Expo has people visiting throughout the year, a huge number of visitors. During this week at Salone, I felt that the city is kind of groaning under the weight of all the extra people who are here at the moment. I mean, how do you think in 4 years you can sort of change the city so that it has the ability to actually cope with such a vast number of visitors?
Well, I think you're right. If you see what has happened in the city who have hosted Expo in the last years, it's quite important to observe the city were successful, but the city were capable to start to talk about the subjects, the contents of the Expo many years before the opening of the events. Now what is happening for instance, I think Shanghai was successful because they started 3 years ago to talk about what to do with new urban condition, our lifestyle in the cities and so on. So that's the point, we have to start now. We have to start now to call the world here to talk about feeding, about the question related to feeding. And this is exactly what we are trying to do. Also in a way which, in my opinion, is quite important because it's, I think, crucial if we really want to have the world here in 2015 to, let me say, incentivate the world who still live in Milano now, so all the foreign communities which are inhabiting Milano, to talk about feeding, to talk about their contribution to agriculture, to the transformation of agricultural products into food. So that's what we are doing now, so to, in a way, involve local communities and foreign communities, international communities in Milano, to also install a cultural exchange with their original countries.
And that brings me on actually to the second question that I wanted to ask, which is about the sort of long term. It's obviously all the clocks are being set for 2015 at the moment, a bit like all the clocks have been set in London for the Olympics for such a long time. But obviously it's an opportunity to transform Milan with a much more sort of long-term view in mind. And this opportunity to sort of think about Milan and what it means today, brand Milan. Mm. What do you think Milan does mean?
Well, no, it's a very delicate point because sometimes all these events could really accelerate the transformation of a city. But this happens only when the city uses events like a goal. Otherwise, if it's something which happens and it's not completely, let me say, not completely run by the political agenda, this could be also an extreme risk because it can move the city from the right direction. So I think what London is doing is extremely interesting. Here, we are observing, following with extreme attention what London is doing for the Olympics, because I think what London is doing is really to use Olympic Games in the right way, no? So to change a part of the city, but at the same time knowing that the legacy has to be run with extreme attention. So, for instance, we were astonished, very, very shocked by the fact that London is planning to move part of the infrastructures that will be realized for the Olympics just after the Olympics in order to leave other kind of landscape to come and superpose them to what is existing. So I think London is planning the legacy of Olympics, we have to learn a lot. Our proposal at the beginning, as you know, was the idea to have a huge botanic garden, no? So a place where all the countries came just to have a piece of ground and to cultivate agriculture and so. And in that case, the idea was that is the Expo, and at the same time, this is the legacy of the Expo. But now these things have changed.
That was Stefano Boeri, Milan's Councillor for Culture, Design and Fashion, in the studio on day 4 of the fair. After a hard day's work at the fair, it's not hard to find an open showroom, courtyard or piazza with a drinks reception happening. Come the early hours, though, and there's only one place to head to in Milan. That's Bar Basso. The small bar acquires legendary status during Salone. Queues for Negronis are 10 deep. Crowds spill over the road and onto the opposite pavement. Friendships are forged and deals are brokered before sunrise. Our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, popped in to ask Bar Basso's owner, Maurizio Stichetto, what the magic's all about.
Hello, I'm Maurizio from Bar Basso Milano, and I'm the owner of Bar Basso, and during the last 2 decades, Bar Basso has become like the home away from home for many designers from all over the world, especially from UK, Northern Scandinavian countries, and Holland, Belgium, almost from everywhere. In the last 20 years, Milano has changed in different kind of ways. But the Salone del Mobile, that in the 80s was in September, was like a little niche, has become one of the biggest events, probably the biggest event in the city. And Barbasso has become one of the main meeting points. The week is very exciting because it has become like a tradition. So one of the interesting things is that it's like a big happening of people that meet just in front of the bar. It's an event with no music because the main thing is just pure communication. Most of the people, actually, they are kind of weary because they have been working all day at the fair, or also they had to attend evenings with dinner for business. And so some of them might drink some Negroni Sbagliato, which is one of our signature drinks, but mostly they have to be in good shape the next morning. So Fragolino, that's a very, very light drink with just fresh strawberries and sparkling wine, is one of the favorite because it's very easy to sip. It's a thirst quencher. It's pleasant, but allows you to work the next day. Also because they're not on vacation, basically. So people think that they might be gullible, but they're actually just taking a break after a tough day. Almost everybody tends to pass here, at least to meet somebody, because it's a good point of reference.
That was Maurizio Stichetto, owner of the legendary Milanese institution, Barbasso. And that brings us to the end of this week's Salone's special edition of Section D. This show was produced by Katie Bilboa and Gillian Tobias. Our editor was Holly Fisher. Next week, we'll hop to the beautiful French town of Hyères to attend the annual Design Prize and Festival that takes place there. And in the spirit of awards, we'll also bring you a series of reports from this year's London Design Museum Designer of the Year event too. Be sure to tune in then. In the meantime, I'm Hugo MacDonald. Have a great week and thank you for listening. Goodbye.